Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your guest host, Zoe Russell. I'm standing in for Radio Free Market founder and regular host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is The Real Lincoln with Dr. Tom DiLorenzo. This is a call-in show, so please call in with your questions at 1-800-313-9443. Again, that's 1-800-313-9443. I am so excited to welcome our guest today, Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo. Hi, Dr. DiLorenzo.
Hi, pleased to be with you.
Great. Thomas DiLorenzo is a professor of economics at Loyola University in Maryland, and he's authored The Real Lincoln, Lincoln Unmasked, and How Capitalism Saved America. And I'd recommend all of these books should be read by anyone desiring an account of American history that's, you know, void of the party line and half-truths you'll find in the other books, you know, those books written by the victors or their personal biographers. So I have to make an admission ahead of the start of the show. I came out of school believing the myth. I thought if there was a local problem, there must be a federal solution. And I think many people my age, I'm 23 years old, have grown up the same way. In fact, I know it because I argue with them all the time. But Abraham Lincoln idolatry is not just a young person's talking point. He's not just a Republican favorite or a Democratic favorite. Lincoln is the end-all, be-all, most beloved president of all time, with volumes of books following in his wake. So I want to venture into this skewed history and pull out some of the most common themes on Lincoln for our myth buster, Dr. Tom DiLorenzo. So, first myth, Lincoln was raised in a log cabin. He had no formal education, and he became a simple prairie lawyer. There's no need to dig into the cases he took or the businesses that hired him. Dr. DiLorenzo, what was Abraham Lincoln's background, his education, and how successful of a lawyer was he?
Well, it was true, you know, his story about him being born in a log cabin, but in the prairie in the early 19th century, everybody lived in a log cabin. So, you know, it's like saying, oh, poor Bill Clinton, he was raised in a bungalow. You know, so there's nothing special about that. It is true that Lincoln had less than 1 year of formal education, and he was, you know, so he educated himself, and he taught himself legal procedures when he became a young man, enough to get his lawyer's license. And he was a lawyer who litigated thousands of cases, and by the time he was in his 40s, he was one of the elite railroad lawyers of the country. His clients included the Illinois Central Railroad and all the major railroads in the Midwest, and he was even offered the job of general counsel of the New York Central Railroad by a man named Erastus Corning in 1857. And so he traveled around the Midwest in a private rail car, courtesy of the Illinois Central, with an entourage of business executives. That's the real Lincoln in terms of who he was. And if you were to go to Springfield, Illinois tomorrow and visit Lincoln's home, there's a part of town called Aristocracy Row. And he lived in the biggest house on what was called Aristocracy Row in Springfield, Illinois, right next, you know, which was the state capital at the time.
So how did he get into politics?
Well, Lincoln got into politics in 1832, and he became a Whig. And it was part of his legal business, really. I consider him to have been a lobbyist as well as anything else, even though I don't think the word lobbyist was even in use back then. But his law office in Springfield, which I've been to, is literally about no more than 75 to 100 paces from the front door of the state capitol. And so he ran for the state legislature, and as a Whig, he announced that the reason he's getting into politics is he wanted to advance the Whig political agenda of high protectionist tariffs, corporate welfare, mostly for the railroad corporations who were his clients, and the central bank to finance all the corporate welfare. That was the agenda of, really, that was the agenda of Alexander Hamilton.
Well, let me interrupt you there, and we'll get back and talk more about the Whig Party planks of that Abraham Lincoln espoused his whole life. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. My name is Zoe Russell. I'm standing in as host for Michael McKay. Our topic today is The Real Lincoln, and we have Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo as our special guest. And remember, everyone, this is a live show, so you can call in at 1-800-313-9443. So we were just talking about how Lincoln was actually a Whig. Most people might remember him as a Republican. Can you tell us, what are the Whig party planks that he espoused his whole life?
Well, Lincoln was a Whig for about 25 years, but a Republican for a much shorter period of time, no less than 10 years. The Whig Party, they called it the American System, and it was given that name by Henry Clay, and they advanced high protectionist tariffs that would benefit primarily northern manufacturers, although there were a few southerners who would have been protected from international competition by that, but very few. They advocated a central bank, a national bank, run by politicians out of the nation's capital, which, of course, is a very bad idea. And they advocated corporate welfare. They didn't call it corporate welfare. They called it internal improvement subsidies. Politicians always have a way of disguising, the truth about what they're doing. And they also, sort of an auxiliary plank was the giveaway of government land. The government stepped in and claimed to own all the land in North America virtually. And they wanted to give it away as a form of patronage, and they ended up doing it with the Homestead Act in the 1860s, when the Republican Party was in control. But most of that land went to corporations. It went to railroads, mining companies, forestry companies, and so forth. And that was the Whig agenda.
So you talk about Henry Clay and the Real Lincoln as Abe's foremost political idol. Can you tell us a little about Henry Clay's background?
When Henry Clay died in 1852, Lincoln said a eulogy to him in Springfield, Illinois, and he said that Henry Clay was the source of all of his political ideas. Any political ideas Lincoln had, he said, came from Henry Clay. He was slavishly devoted to his economic agenda. He also was, Lincoln was devoted to Henry Clay's policy of colonization of black people, which is another word for deportation. For his entire adult life, Abe Lincoln advocated the deportation of all black people from America, and he even did some of this when he was president. They sent about 500 free blacks to Liberia in Africa, and even almost on his dying day, a few days before he was assassinated, Lincoln met General Benjamin Butler to discuss how to colonize the slaves if they were to be freed, in several months with the war being pretty much over at that point. And so that's what Lincoln said. Everything he got, all the ideas from politics came from Henry Clay, and he was right. They advocated the same things for many, many years.
So how did Lincoln fanatics or Lincoln apologists explain the colonization plan that Lincoln had all his life?
Colonization, well, that's a lot of the embarrassing things about Lincoln. I found out that to be a Lincoln scholar, you dream up excuses for these bad things that he advocated, like so-called colonization. The funniest excuse that I've ever run across was from a well-known Civil War historian named Gabor Borat. He teaches at Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania. And with regard to Lincoln's advocacy of colonization, he said that I can quote him directly. He said, "This is how honest people lie."
Yeah.
I quote him in one of his books. He said Lincoln was an honest man, but he was lying when he did this. But that's simply nonsense, because Lincoln actually acted on it. He actually did colonize some free blacks. In my book, Lincoln Unmasked, I got into the collected works of Abraham Lincoln, which anyone can do. They're online. And you can find in 1862, the minutes of an 1862 meeting that Lincoln had with some free black men in the White House, he urged them to go to Liberia, leave the country, and lead by example. So this wasn't just Lincoln's words. This was his actions with regard to colonization. And Gabor Borat is just nonsensical when he says that. His other defenders will say, well, he gave up on this idea sometime around 1864. That's their defense of him. But he didn't. As I said a minute ago, he did meet with General Butler a few days before he died, and he was still talking about colonization.
Wow.
At the very end.
So going back to, the economic side of things, I was reading your book, The Real Lincoln, and you'd think that if any wise politician could oversee how to correctly spend money on internal improvements, it would be Lincoln, our benevolent dictator. But how did his and other internal improvement projects pan out in the 1830s and afterward?
Well, yeah, Lincoln was a leader of the Whigs in the Illinois legislature, and he was as responsible as anybody for the legislature in Illinois spending about $11 million on road and canal building projects. He wanted to turn New York or Illinois into the sort of the New York State of the Midwest. He wants to say the Empire State of the Midwest. But what happened was nothing was finished. Not a single road, not a single canal. Over $10 million was spent. Much of it was stolen. The people of the state were put deep into debt for many years, and they had to raise their taxes to pay off the debt for years and years to come. And it was one big giant debacle, but of course somebody made a lot of money. So all the contractors of the politically connected businesses. And Lincoln really demonstrated that he could get things done for his constituency, which was basically the wealthy manufacturers of the Midwest and the East Coast. And so that was such a debacle in state after state that by the time you get to the Civil War, every single state except Massachusetts had amended its constitution to prohibit the use of tax dollars for corporations for any purpose because it had been such a debacle. But Lincoln was connected with that as much as any politician in America was in the 1830s.
So I know in Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, Team of Rivals, she says, "It is clear that Lincoln won the nomination because he was shrewdest and canniest of them all. He displayed a fierce ambition and exceptional political acumen and a wide range of emotional strengths." And you contrast that with Murray Rothbard's quote, "Lincoln was a master politician," which means that he was a consummate conniver, manipulator, and liar. Why are we taught to admire these politicians for being adept at manipulation and rhetoric?
Well, Doris Kearns Goodwin is the worst example of what is called a court historian. She spent her whole career writing books that make excuses for the evil deeds of politicians. She wrote a biography of Lyndon Johnson in which she admitted that she actually slept with Lyndon Johnson.
Wow.
And of course, he was a disaster with the mm-hmm. Vietnam War and the inflation that was created during his regime. And so she writes a big fat book making excuses for him. She did the same thing with the Kennedys, and now she's doing that. And she was, actually she got caught plagiarizing over 100 pages of one of her books, and she got kicked off the Pulitzer Prize Committee, and she got kicked off of PBS for a while. And then this Lincoln book, though, came around later. It's sort of her redemption to write
right.
the Lincoln book. But it's statist idolatry, and it's worst, but it's very profitable and lucrative for people like Doris Kearns Goodwin, who get appointed to big jobs, they get put on television, and they get big Hollywood contracts for their books. The word is Steven Spielberg is making a movie out of her book.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln was a consummate politician, but like Murray Rothbard said, that means he was a consummate liar, manipulator, and conniver. And people should be taught the reality about politics in school, not fluff like Doris Kearns Goodwin presents to us.
Right. It's almost they stretch it to the point where they'd want us to believe that those people looking to be president do so for our benefit and not their own. They stretch it so far as to say, look how hard Lincoln worked to become president. Also, he could end slavery, or also he could protect us.
Well, he didn't end slavery. The states did when they ratified the 13th Amendment. As far as that goes, and as I've written a lot of places, that the whole world ended slavery peacefully. There's a great book called Greatest Emancipations by Jim Powell that documents how the whole rest of the world, including the northern states, including Massachusetts and New York, where slavery existed for several hundred years, they all found a way to end slavery peacefully through some sort of compensated emancipation. The British, for example, just bought up all the slaves, freed them, on the British Empire, and then said no more. That's it. And we could have done the same thing, but Lincoln chose to use the slaves as pawns in a war that really wasn't about them. It was about consolidating all political power in Washington to adopt the Whig economic agenda, finally, which had been fought over in politics for 75 years.
So that brings us to our next legend, our myth of Abraham Lincoln, that he did invade the South for slavery. Did he ever seriously try to abolish slavery through compensated emancipation?
Well, you wouldn't even find any serious historians nowadays that'll say Lincoln invaded the South to free the slaves. He was very adamant in saying, no, that's not the reason for the war. He publicly stated that at the time, and so did the U.S. Congress. Congress and Lincoln announced to the world that the purpose of the war was to save the Union, not to do anything about slavery. In fact, he made an ironclad defense of slavery in his first inaugural address, where he advocated a constitutional amendment that would have expressly put slavery right in the Constitution, in the text of the Constitution. And early in the war, some of Lincoln's generals tried to free some of the slaves where the U.S. Army was in control, and Lincoln rebuked them and stripped them of their command. And the Emancipation Proclamation itself, by the way, exempted all the areas of the United States, or of North America, really, where the Union Army could have actually freed people. West Virginia, for example, Lincoln illegally caused the secession of West Virginia to be the last slave state to enter the Union, and it specifically was exempted by words in the Emancipation Proclamation. So it didn't really free anybody as far as that's concerned. And Lincoln did talk about compensated emancipation in the border states as a war measure. He called it a war measure, but he coupled it with colonization. Any slaves that would have been freed would have been immediately deported.
Oh,
and
well.
His defenders usually omit the second part.
Well, I guess we'll come back to this point of Lincoln's view of egalitarianism and equality of the races after the break. We're here with Thomas DiLorenzo. I'm Zoe Russell, guest host, standing in for Michael McCain. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm Zoe Russell, standing in for Michael McKay. Our topic today is The Real Lincoln, and I'm here with Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo. Please call us at 1-800-313-9443 if you have any questions. We were just talking about the issue of slavery. I know that a lot of Lincoln scholars say, Lincoln could have chosen another route if he wanted to free the slaves. He could have chosen compensated emancipation, but here's where the Lincoln scholars get really tricky. They say Lincoln did want to end slavery, so he invaded the South to keep the Union together and was able, out of his political genius, to save the Union and end slavery at the same time. Wouldn't you say this is a stretch?
They omit the fact that 670,000 Americans died. So that's a tiny little fact that they usually omit, totally unnecessarily, as far as that goes. And that's back when the population of the country was 30 million. So today, if you standardize that, it would be the equivalent of 6.7 million Americans dying, worse than the Holocaust. And so he didn't save the Union either. The Union of the Founding Fathers was a voluntary union. Just read Article 7 of the Constitution, where it says that the Constitution is to be ratified by the citizens of the states. And so also read Article 3, Section 3 of the Constitution, which defines treason as, quote, waging war against the states. That's what treason is under the U.S. Constitution. It's not criticizing Abe Lincoln or Barack Obama. It's waging war against the states. That's what the Constitution says. So Lincoln's invasion of the southern states was the very definition of treason under the United States Constitution. But he and his regime, he essentially became a dictator during his regime, redefined treason as criticism of him. He even said at one point publicly that whenever he and his administration are being discussed and a man stands by and says nothing, that's treasonous, even if you're quiet. And whenever I've written about this, I've had emails from people from Eastern Europe and Central Europe who said, under communism, that's what they did. If you don't proclaim your loyalty loudly to the communist government, you could be thrown in the gulag. And that was Lincoln's policy during his time. And of course, with slavery, like I said, the whole world ended slavery peacefully. There was no war that was necessary. The war was necessary to destroy federalism. That's why the war was necessary, to establish monopoly government so that the Republicans could adopt finally the Whig economic agenda at gunpoint. And the slavery, as far as I'm concerned, is all one big smokescreen for these people, as far as that's concerned.
So I know that in your book, The Real Lincoln, you also defeated the common belief that Lincoln championed the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal. Did he really think that?
No, of course not. If you read some of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, I have some of it almost memorized, the one line where he said that I, as much as any man, want the superior position to be to the white race. Now, those are Lincoln's words, and he said he's against making voters or jurors of Negroes. He was against intermarriage of the races. He supported the Illinois Constitution, which prohibited the immigration of black people into the state. He supported the Illinois Black Codes, which deprived the free blacks in Illinois of any semblance of citizenship. And he also was a manager of the Illinois Colonization Society that used tax dollars to deport black people out of the state. Lincoln said in many occasions that when he talked about equality, he didn't mean in this country. He meant he would use phrases like in their native clime. If black people could go back to Africa or someplace like that, they could be equal to each other there. But he did not believe they could ever be equal to whites or to him. He was very clear on that. And so when you read Lincoln's words on equality, you have to read his speeches like you read a Bill Clinton speech. There are a lot of weasel words in there. And so he definitely didn't believe that. And he perverted the whole meaning of the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence was a declaration of secession from the British Empire. It wasn't a Lincoln document. It wasn't a Union Forever document.
Mm-hmm.
Read the last parts of the Declaration of Independence. It calls the states free and independent and says that they are free and independent to do what states do, that is to wage war and raise taxes. And so it didn't say that the Union was perpetual. And so he totally perverted the whole meaning of the Declaration of Independence.
Well, we have a caller in, Ray from California. Ray, do you have a question for Dr. DiLorenzo?
Yeah, this may not be the place for the question, but I just thought I'd at least pose it.
Go for it.
How do we get this, the truth of this, into our classrooms so that the kids understand the truth?
I think each of us has to do whatever we can with the people we know and who are around us. I think we have to forget about any kind of national policy or something like that. I get letters from teachers all the time saying they're using my books, for example, and other books like this. And parents need to educate their children, even if they're not homeschooling them. They need to do some homeschooling. I think every responsible parent needs to educate their children to some extent, and sometime giving them books, you know, and maybe rewarding them for reading extra books like this or whatever you can do to educate your own kids. Don't just leave it up to the government schools or even the private school. The private schools, most school teachers are educated at state universities, so they're fed the same propaganda. And then just because they work in a private school doesn't mean your children are not taught government propaganda. If that's what the teachers know, that's what they'll teach.
All right. Well, I guess that's a good place. All right, that's a good place to end, and we'll just have to come back, and we'll have our long segment next with Dr. DiLorenzo, topic The Real Lincoln. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm Zoe Russell, standing in for Michael McKay. We have Thomas DiLorenzo, and we were just talking about how we can demystify Lincoln to everyone you know, students especially. One of the spectacular lies, as it's called, is the idea that the South had no constitutional right to secede. I just read on whitehouse.gov, though, that Lincoln thought secession was illegal, so he used federal power to invade the South and protect the law. So if the president says it's not so, did the states actually have the right to secede?
Well, ask yourself this question. If read Article 7 of the Constitution, which says that the states ratify the Constitution didn't ratify the states, and ask yourself if the Founding Fathers would have adopted the Constitution if it said that if any state changes its mind at any time in the future, the U.S. government has the right to invade that state, mass murder its civilian population, and burn its towns to the ground. That's what Lincoln's army did on many occasions. And of course, the answer to that question would be absolutely not. That would be preposterous for anyone to even contemplate that James Madison would have supported the United States Constitution or Thomas Jefferson if that's what it said. Jefferson himself supported the idea of secession late in his life. People asked him what would happen if the Union broke apart into several sections. And what he said was, they will all be our children, they will all be Americans, and we would wish them all well. Lincoln was very different. He was the anti-Jefferson. He pretty much said, pay federal taxes or die. He was really a horrible tyrant in that regard. And as I said, the Union was voluntary. The New England Federalists plotted for 14 years to secede from the Union after Thomas Jefferson was elected. Northern abolitionists wanted to secede because they didn't want to be a part of a country that had slaves in it. There was a secession movement in the middle states, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, New York, and Pennsylvania in the 1850s. Up until Lincoln, the Americans believed, well, of course we have a right to secede. The Union is voluntary. Lincoln just simply made up out of thin air the idea that the Union was somehow a one-way Venus flytrap from which you could never escape. And of course, further evidence is that at the outset of the war, the Congress proposed several laws to outlaw secession, and that would tell you that they knew it was legal. Otherwise, why would you need a law to make it illegal?
Right.
And after the war, it wasn't until after the war that the Supreme Court, which was a kangaroo court of Lincoln appointees by then, issued a declaration that secession was unconstitutional. But it never did that beforehand.
Well, we have a caller, Leo, from Massachusetts. Leo, do you have a question?
Hi, thanks for taking the call. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder, do you bring up the aspect of J.P. Morgan agitating both sides of this, and that the Rothschilds wanted to break up the United States into two separate countries?
Well, if that's true, that doesn't mean they had any ability to do it. In fact, Jefferson believed that the kind of constitutional republic that was created in his time probably wouldn't work as the population got bigger and the government and the country got bigger after the Louisiana Purchase. That's why he was referring to earlier. I mentioned he was in letters in the 1820s before he died of maybe five or six or seven different confederacies. And that's how federalism, American federalism, could work. Even if somebody from Europe or anywhere else wanted to break the country up into different sections, that would have been a virtue, not a vice, because you look at our government now. It's really preposterous to think that we have 535 people regulate the lives of 330 million.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, the thing is just that, from what I've understood, that J.P. Morgan was a major activist on both sides, and the South did support was supported by.
There was no major secret Wizard of Oz string puller with bags of money in his pockets. There were a lot of people involved. There were a lot of people who lent money to the U.S. government to finance the war. The South went into debt also to finance his side of the war. There was no one Wizard of Oz that was manipulating this. I've had other people tell me that the Pope was behind the war somehow, but there have been other repercussions of the
Civil War that aren't discussed. There's a book called Early Victorian Holocaust, and that was about how England, because of the blockade of the South, forced India to grow cotton to the detriment of the food production. And this was caused by a net effect of our Civil War. And that's not discussed. But the important point, I think, here is that England, the Rothschilds of England, France, and Spain all wanted the United States broken up, and they supported the South as one methodology to break up the Union. And
yeah, thank you for your call. We've got to cover some more Lincoln stuff. So, well, I guess I'll just go into another topic. I want to talk about Lincoln's method of total war, of complete destruction, scorched earth warfare. Can you tell us what was the makeup of this policy that he had?
Well, from the very beginning of the war, the very first major battle, the Battle of First Manassas, civilians were targeted, their private property was destroyed and taken. And, you know, some of the, and it got worse and worse as the war went on. For example, in Atlanta, Georgia, the Confederate Army had left. There was no army there. And so for 4 or 5 days, General Sherman used the private homes as target practice for his cannons. And they burned down and destroyed 90% of Atlanta. And this is after the army had gone. There was no army in Atlanta. It was just waging war on civilians. And then, when it was over, there were about 2,500 civilians left. They were forced out of their homes in November after two big armies had just passed through the area. There was no food or anything around to speak of. And then the entire Shenandoah Valley was burned down. All the homes, all the businesses, all the farms, all the cattle and the livestock were stolen by the U.S. Army. And it was occupied at that time by no army. It was 1864. Only women and children and old men and handicapped men who were war veterans. And they were all forced out of their homes. And if you read the famous book, Civil War Trilogy, or any account of the Shenandoah Valley, the burning of the Shenandoah Valley, there were thousands of women and children and old men just walking up the valley, wandering around homeless as a result of that. The historian Jeffrey Hummel says that he estimated that about 50,000 Southern civilians were killed in the war, and that had to include a lot of slaves and free blacks who lived in the South as well. And so this was the first example in modern times of total war that we saw in World War I and World War II in Europe. And Grant, Sherman, Sheridan, and Lincoln laid the groundwork. They set the example for the ugliness of total war in civilians that we saw in the 20th century.
So it's the myth that Lincoln was at once a master commander, micromanager of the army, but completely unaware of these civilian deaths. I know that he's described
as
one of the tall tales
told by James McPherson, the historian. He brags in one of his books about what a great micromanager of the war effort Lincoln was. He knew everything. He spent the endless hours in the War Department telegraph office, and McPherson says, but then he's supposedly totally unaware of all the death and destruction that was going on. And I think no one above the age of 3 ought to believe such a thing. But that's what Lincoln's excuse makers say. In fact, in my book, I quote Sherman from his memoirs as saying that when he met up with Lincoln after Sherman's march, Lincoln especially enjoyed the stories of the plundering of the Southern civilians and their property. So, of course, he knew about this. He was instructing it. And another thing Lincoln did that has come out fairly recently by the mainstream historians is that he tried to assassinate Jefferson Davis. There was a captain in the Union Army named Dahlgren who was killed in the outside of Richmond, and he had orders on him with Abe Lincoln's signatures on him to assassinate Jefferson Davis. And modern forensics has been used to determine that that was, in fact, Abe Lincoln's signature, and so this actually happened. And this is not me, the Lincoln critic that has said this. This is a historian by the name of Sears, who's written many fine books on such things as the Battle of Chancellorsville and, you know, some of the famous Civil War battles, but he's the one who did the research on this.
Okay, let's take one more caller real quick. Coy from Missouri, are you there with a question?
Yes, ma'am. I wanted to maybe explain one of the reasons maybe for Lincoln's lust for power and his aggressiveness and his drive. And this is something that I didn't believe when I first heard it, and I started researching it, and I found it confirmed a number of times. But it is when Lincoln went to marry Mary Todd, her family didn't want her to marry him, and they insisted that he change his name because they didn't want their family associated with that nationality, and so he changed his name. To Lincoln, his name originally was Abraham Springsteen.
Thanks, Coy, for calling.
You're welcome. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
I've never heard that story before. Mm-hmm. First time I've heard it.
But I don't think it's too deniable that he had a lust for power, maybe.
Well, yeah, I think anybody who rises to that political office is somewhat of an egomaniac, and Abe Lincoln was no exception. He was widely regarded as a master politician, so he had to be the type of person was just, an egomaniacal is the only word for it. That's, somebody who wants to be president and someone who would do the things he did, such as suspending the writ of habeas corpus and arresting and imprisoning without due process tens of thousands of northern civilians. You know, anyone who would do, take it upon themselves to do such a thing has a really dictatorial mindset.
So what could have gotten you thrown in jail by Lincoln and his secret police?
Anybody who criticized the government, there was a confiscation law, for example, that was passed that said that anybody who even said something positive about the opposing side, about the Confederate Army, could have all of his private property confiscated by the government. And the U.S. government had spies everywhere. They recruited spies just like the KGB did in Soviet Union days to report on people who were suspected of doubting Lincoln and his administration. And as I said, Lincoln himself said, even if you're silent and do not proclaim your support of his administration, he considered that to be treasonous. And that's how thousands of Northerners, including the mayor of Baltimore, Francis Scott Key's grandson, who was a newspaper editor who editorialized against suspending the writ of habeas corpus, a congressman from Maryland was put in prison. And Lincoln even deported the most outspoken member of the Democratic Party, Clement Vallandigham of Dayton, Ohio, for merely criticizing him. And Lincoln came along and his administration claimed that he was deterring enlistment in the Army by criticizing the administration. Therefore, they deported him. And these were all the acts of a tyrant and a dictator.
So with a lawyer's mind, he also discovered lots of new powers in the Constitution for the executive branch. What were some of these powers?
He invented many war powers. He actually invaded, launched an invasion of the southern states before the Congress got involved, and he funded it, too. That really was not a presidential power that he had. The president does not have the power to suspend the writ of habeas corpus. It can be suspended, but it has to be suspended by Congress, according to the U.S. Constitution. And Congress did eventually get around to doing that. But then after the Civil War, the U.S. Supreme Court said that it was illegal for either of them, Congress or the president, to have done it as long as the civil courts in the North were operating, which they were. And so even Lincoln's defenders call him a benevolent dictator. They'll say he was a dictator, but he was a good dictator. And that's the old ends justify the means philosophy. That's the philosophy of every tyrant in the history of the world. The ends justify the means. And that's what the so-called Lincoln scholars all say about this.
And even though they found it to be illegal that he suspended habeas corpus, because of the Indemnity Act, there would have been no way to go after him. Can you tell us about the Indemnity Act?
Well, yes, they had a law passed, an Indemnity Act passed Congress saying that you couldn't go after Lincoln or his administration or anybody involved in the illegal imprisonment of people during the war. And that's why, by the way, after the war, some of the lawyers in the North, especially in places like New York City, were very adamant about enforcing the Constitution. And one of them, a man named O'Connor, volunteered to be Jefferson Davis's lawyer when they put Davis in prison for 3 years after the Civil War. But this man, O'Connor from New York City, who was considered to be a top lawyer in the country, lent his time to get Jefferson Davis finally out of prison. And because he, like other Northerners, were disgusted at the imprisonment of many of their clients without due process during the war.
So Lincoln also introduced the military-industrial complex to us. So I know that some people call it the military-industrial-financial complex. How did Lincoln finance his war?
This was the first big major war where there were massive military contracts given out to finance the war. For example, when I was in Springfield, Illinois, Lincoln's hometown, his next-door neighbor, there's a little plaque next to the house of his next-door neighbor, and it said that he got the contract for tin cups to the U.S. Army during the Civil War. And I'm sure that was not a competitive bid. It was a sweetheart deal. He was another well-connected member of the Whig Party in Illinois who happened to have a tin cup manufacturing business, and so he got the contract. And so that sort of thing really got started with the Civil War. And then, of course, it exploded with World War One and World War Two. But, you know, if you want to talk about, I call it the military-industrial congressional complex, because it involves Congress, too, being involved in handing out sweetheart non-bid contracts. But that's where it all got started.
I see. So, and obviously we still have consequences from the financial side of Lincoln today and lots of other consequences just from his dictatorship. Can you tell us about some of those consequences that we're still facing?
Oh, yeah. Well, every time the government wants to abolish some more of our civil liberties, they usually start quoting Abraham Lincoln. All during the reign of George W. Bush, his supporters kept saying, well, we need to suspend habeas corpus. Michelle Malcolm, the journalist, wanted to start putting Muslim Americans in concentration camps. She wrote a whole book on it, about it. But they always quote Abe Lincoln by saying, if Lincoln did it, therefore it must be right to do. And so that's one bad example that he set, the evisceration of the Constitution. But also, you know, more substantially, he highly centralized the government control of the money supply with the Legal Tender Act and the National Currency Act. It was an important road on the way to the creation of the Fed some years later. We had high tariffs imposed at the 50 to 60% level. It lasted for 60 years after the Civil War.
Well, let me interrupt you there.
They opened up the whole ball game of corporate welfare en masse.
We'll come back and talk more about the American system. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. When we left off, Dr. DiLorenzo, you were talking about the continuation of the American system that we have today as one of the main consequences of Lincoln. Do people see this mercantilist system as capitalism?
Yeah, that's been a big area of confusion for a long time. You know, beginning with Lincoln's regime, we've basically transformed the U.S. economy into really economic fascism, the ostensible private property that is so heavily regulated and controlled by government that it's not really private. It's to a very large extent, it serves the purposes of the state as much as anything. You know, every business person knows that they have spent endless hours complying with governmental edicts and regulations, for example. And also, on the other end of it, they lobby for favors and subsidies and all sorts of other things. And that really is one of the legacies of the Lincoln administration, which was finally the final victory of the old Hamiltonian idea from Alexander Hamilton of the connection between business and government. But that's not capitalism. Capitalism is free markets. It's voluntary exchange. It's using the price system. It's not crony capitalism. That's what we've got today and have had for a long, long time. Crony capitalism to a very large extent. It's not 100% of our economy, but it's a very, very big part of it. And that's, it all got started with the Civil War. Even if you, ignore the whole issue of slavery, there are other things that came out as a consequence of the war. And this is one of them, and it's a bad consequence. That's one of the reasons I wrote my book, How Capitalism Saved America, to try to educate some people on what capitalism really is. And it's not the system that gets blamed for all the troubles we're in, like, such as the housing fiasco. I mean, that was created by the Fed, the housing market fiasco, the Fed and Fannie Mae and other government institutions that influenced the housing industry. It wasn't the free market.
Right. It's extremely important to get an actual economist viewpoint on history rather than just historians that have no education in economics.
Historians are not shy about making pronouncements about economics, even though they have never studied the subject for one day. And the Lincoln historians are especially bad in that regard. And they tend to say very silly things like, he had good intentions, therefore his policies must have been good. But of course, anybody, you know, above the age of 10 ought to understand that good intentions don't necessarily lead to good results. People can make mistakes based on, bad knowledge or lack of knowledge of the field of economics.
Right. And in Lincoln's case, it was both bad. He had bad intentions and bad economics. Can you tell us about
Well, he was a politician. It's
right.
Always a very dangerous thing for
the right incentive
to have egomaniacal politicians in charge.
Can you tell us about your online Mises Academy course, The Great Centralizer?
Yes. You go to Mises.org, M-E-S-E-S.org, and click on Mises Academy. I'm teaching a 6-week online course on Lincoln, The Great Centralizer, one night a week for a 45-minute lecture and then about an hour of Q&A. And students get a very nice certificate of accomplishment at the end if they wish, if they want to take quizzes and get a grade, they can do that, or they can just take it for their general knowledge. And I also put together some nice online readings that can be very educational for the students. And it should be fun. It begins on this Tuesday, the 18th of January.
So we still have time to enroll in it.
Yes, you can still enroll even up to a week or so after the course starts because the lectures will be taped.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Dr. DiLorenzo, for being our guest today. I know that course will be awesome because there was so much that we didn't cover today. So I'm going to leave us with what Lou Rockwell always says about you. I want professors and Lincoln Court historians to have the fear of Tom DiLorenzo in you. You'll always have to worry that the truth about Abraham Lincoln has filtered into your classroom. So you don't have to be in school, but students of every age, y'all should sign up for this Mises Academy course at mises.org. So signing off, this is Zoe Russell with Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com. You can subscribe to all of our shows on iTunes or download this and all of our archives for free. Until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Tom.